Maybe this is happening to it. Maybe my kids died because of the sin in this man's life. And maybe that's why he was repulsive to her. I mean, I think that's not a real stretch. But that makes sense for Job's response, saying, I've pleaded with her for the sake of the children. They were my children too. They were as much part of my body as they were part of her body. I love them. I don't know. I just throw that out to you. If that's true, if that's what he's saying, it just breaks my heart. All of these people who turned away from Job were the very people who should have come close. Once again, it is very poignant as why of all of the family that Satan killed, why did he leave Job's wife? She was not a comfort to him. And once again, not to fault her, she had this almost all the same losses that he did. But she just didn't have the faith in God. So she couldn't stand and support him when he was suffering. And that's, I believe, why Satan allowed these friends to come. Do you think these guys would have been allowed to poke their noses into Job's life if they had come to build him up and trust God and say, hey, don't worry, just, you know, be patient. We know that you're a good man and we don't understand, but we just know God is good. Do you think that would have happened? I often, the more I hear them talk and see how wrong they are, I think, you know, who was it that inspired them to go talk to Job? Well, it certainly wasn't God. We do know that. Verse 18 is so sad. Even young children despise me. I arise, or I get up, and they speak against me. All my close friends abhor me, and those whom I love have turned against me. My bone clings to my skin and to my flesh, and I have escaped by the skin of my teeth. That phrase sound familiar? That's where it came from, the book of Job. Have pity on me. It's on a different page in my Bible, and it's part of the same statement about all my friends are against me. Have pity on me. Have pity on me, you, my friends, for the hand of God has struck me. Why do you persecute me as God does? And are you not satisfied with my flesh? I pondered that. Of course, we know it wasn't God's hand that struck him. But I've pondered what he is saying. And it's weird, but he's the only one that's using real clear logic in all of this. And we're going to see in chapter 21 that he points out very, very clearly that their whole argument about the, you know, the wicked man being suddenly cut off in his prime, Job just says, I'm sorry, that isn't my experience. My experience is that wicked people live long, healthy lives, and their kids don't die all at the same time, and they don't have sores all over their body, so that just doesn't hold water. It's not logical. So many of the things that they say are not logical. But here's what Job is saying. If, as you say, this is all my fault, and you think that, look at my body and how messed up it is, and you think I deserve that, why aren't you satisfied with that? Why do you have to persecute me as well? And that's a really good question. Remember that pathetic cry that Job gave two chapters ago where he says, if you were in my shoes, I wouldn't treat you this way. If I came all this way to talk to you, I would comfort you. My words would be strengthening and healing. It's really what we should come to expect from friends, isn't it? I love these next few verses. This is the lowest point in Job's life. Probably none of us are ever going to go through this kind of a low point that Job's life has taken at this point, but I just love what he says. Oh, that, and I'm going to read it the way that the most my most trusted translations read, "Oh, that these words I now speak were written down. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book. Oh, that they were engraved on a rock with an iron pen and lead forever." What words? The words he's about to say. "I know that my Redeemer lives. And he shall stand at last on the earth." The Amplified Bible says, "He will be the last one standing." Something about that I really like. "After my skin is destroyed, this I know, in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold him." My New King James says, "and not another." But it footnotes saying that the Hebrew word could also be rendered, "My eyes shall behold him and not as a stranger." And I like that. "Oh, how my heart yearns within me. Oh, that these words would be written down. I know my Redeemer lives." Remember, he didn't have any scriptures. This is the first book in the Bible to be written. Don't you just want to say, "Oh, Job, they are. They are written down." You know what I find really, really poignant? "Oh, that they were engraved on a rock." You know what I read? I read that of the two most common scriptures engraved on tombstones by believers, this is number one. "I know that my Redeemer lives, and whom I shall see for myself." Portions of that, of those two verses. Isn't that something? "Oh, that this would be written on a rock." Oh, Job, it's going to be written on about a million rocks. I just want to camp here for a minute. We got lots of time. Because it begs the question, how did Job know this? The language of verses 23, 24, 25, 26, and 27 are so messianic, aren't they? "My Redeemer lives. He shall stand at last on the earth. After my skin is destroyed, this I know, that in my flesh I shall see God." He understands resurrection. Where did he know this? There's no temple. There's only one priest that we know of that lived at this time. His name was Melchizedek. I love what you said, Mary. Ever since you said that a couple of weeks ago, I haven't been able to get it out of my head. Because I said, well, how did Job know this stuff? You know, he lived in a pagan land where people were primarily polytheistic. How did Abraham know? They lived about the same time in about the same area. How did Abraham come to believe in the one true God? Well, we know at least that Abraham had contact with Melchizedek. And we know also that God came to Abraham, perhaps all by himself. And Melchizedek is just an interesting character. I've been pondering that. In fact, I looked at, there aren't very many scriptures about him. But I looked up a few scriptures about Melchizedek, and here's what it said. He was a king. He was called the King of Salem, which means the King of Peace. It could mean the King of Jerusalem, but Salem means peace. He was also called the priest of the Most High God. So he's a king, and he's a priest. And one scripture says he didn't have a mother or a father, but his beginning was from eternity, and his ending was through eternity. Meaning that he's viewed as an eternal character. Now, I don't know if that's poetic language or what. I don't know, and I don't know that it matters, but it's been intriguing ever since you said that. How did he know? Here's what we do know. When he said, "I know my Redeemer lives," the word in the tense in Hebrew means to know by experience. I know right now something that I have learned by experience. My Redeemer lives. So that kind of tips the scales to me. I'll never forget Pastor Chuck, and when I first started going there in 1969 to Calvary Chapel in Costa Mesa, he said, you know, there's a lot of stuff I don't know. I'm constantly running into things I don't know. He said, you know what I do when I run into stuff I don't know? I fall back on what I do know, and I rest there. I stand on what I do know is true. And here's Job at the lowest point in his life saying, you know, maybe God's beat me up. Maybe he's not. You know, if I could just talk to him, maybe we could straighten this out. But he said, I do know this. I know my Redeemer lives. Now remember, Job thinks he's dying. So he says, this flesh is rotting off of my body as we speak. But someday, in my flesh, I'm going to stand and look my Redeemer in the eye. Man, that's what an affirmation of faith. I can promise you that you are going to run up against stuff that you don't understand. You're going to, if you're, especially if you have a shallow of a belief system as these friends of Job had, as many people do today, there's going to be a lot of stuff that doesn't fit into the books. We're going to need something foundational to stand on. Knowing by experience that your Redeemer lives is the best foundation that I know. Because people can say, oh, you're stupid, you're brainwashed, and they go, you know what? I know Jesus because he's been with me. I read a great story in one of my devotionals about a guy that snuck into a church every day for about a week, walked down to the front, stood by the altar, and you know, stayed there about 10 minutes and then went out. And of course the caretaker was afraid the guy was scoping the place out to steal the altar implements. So he finally stopped the guy and he said, sir, can I help you? What are you doing? He says, well, I just come in here to pray. And the caretaker says, well, you're not praying very long. He says, well, I don't say much, but I know he hears me. I just come in and I say, Lord Jesus, it's Jim. And then I leave. Sometime later, that man was struck by an automobile and was in intensive care. In a ward full of crotchety, old, bitter, angry people, little by little after he got there, people started looking up. And one of the nurses said, something's going on here. These are not the same men that they were. And they asked one of the men what had happened. And he said, it's this guy over here. He's suffering worse than the rest of us, but he doesn't seem to be down. And sometimes we hear him singing. And he talks to God like God's right there. And the nurse went over and talked to him. And he said, well, you know, the reason that I'm so happy, yeah, my body hurts. But he said, do you know what? Every day at the same time, Jesus comes and stands at the end of my bed and says, Jim, it's Jesus. I read that and I started weeping. And I thought, that's me. That's my life. When I thought I didn't have anybody, I lost everybody. I didn't lose him. And he would come to me. Now, you can think I'm flaky, but you know what? If that happens to you, nobody can ever take that away. All the theological arguments in the world cannot undo. I know by experience that my Redeemer lives. It's worth knowing, isn't it? And I keep thinking of that Max Lucado quote, you never know for sure that Jesus is all you need till Jesus is all you've got. Then you know, and that's worth knowing. Oh, I wish my words would be written down. Well, they have been many songs right here in this very book, a bestseller, in fact. Oh, that they would just be engraved on a rock. Boy, they have. I know that my Redeemer lives. My eyes shall behold him. I love that one rendering of the Hebrew that says, my eyes shall behold him and not as a stranger. Don't you just look forward to that day? I have more people that I'm close, that I have been close to, that I love in heaven than I do on earth at this point in my life. Happens to a lot of people in their 60s. People that you love. And man, you just yearn to see them. But that's not the face I look forward to seeing the most. I just want to see Jesus flash that smile at me and say, "Son, you did good. Come and share in the happiness of your master." That's what I live for. Isn't it something? Job's at the lowest point in his life, and this is the bedrock. This is what he stands on. And if you take it in context, he still thinks it's God that's punching him in the nose. If you should say, speaking to Bildad, to his friends, if you should say, verse 28, "How shall we persecute him and claim the root of the matter is found in me, that I'm at fault for all of this?" To paraphrase, verse 29 says, "Then if I were you, I would be afraid of the sword for yourselves." I don't think there's anything wrong between me and the Lord. You think there is, and that's why all this came crashing down. If I were you, I'd be sweating bullets right now. Because wrath brings the punishment of the sword so that you may know there is a judgment. That is a parable, or not a parable, a proverb, which loosely translated is saying that the reason why there's punishment for wicked people is so wicked people will stop being wicked people. You know, the reason why judgment happens is so that it will be a deterrent. We've kind of lost sight of that, haven't we? When criminals know they're not going to get punished, then there's nothing to deter them. But we want to be nice to criminals in our culture. We don't want to make them have a poor self-image. So we'll give them a nice warm place to stay and cable TV and a huge library so that they can get a law degree while they're in prison. No, the Bible example is, you know, when there's punishment for sin, people take note of that and they learn, and hopefully it will prevent them from being in judgment. So that's the last thing he's saying to these people. Look, if you guys think this could happen to me, you might want to watch out for yourselves. Then Zophar, verse 1 of chapter 20, the Naamathite answered and said, "Therefore," and it's awkward in English, but what he's saying, you know, that thing that you just said about me being worried about judgment, sorry, can't keep my mouth shut, I need to answer this quickly. Wouldn't you just love to see the movie of this where you can see the interchange? Job's defending himself to Bildad over here, and Zophar just can't keep his mouth shut. He's got to come in, and he said, "Therefore, my anxious thoughts make me answer because of the turmoil inside me. I've heard the rebuke that reproaches me, but the spirit of my understanding causes me to answer." The next 24 verses could all be summed up in one thing when he describes the wicked man. Same speech he gave before. But he's can all be summed up in Job. This is you, buddy. This is you. You're the wicked man. This is what is going down in your life, and it's because you're wicked. So I'll just read what he says. I think I can do this. I want to spend time in chapter 21, and last night I didn't get to. So we just heard Zophar's accusation, but we didn't get to hear Job's answer. And Job's answer is, I think, fabulous. It's great logic. Once again, same theme from Zophar. Do you not know this of old? In other words, the stuff that we've been saying, that, you know, bad stuff happens to bad people. Wicked people are cut off. They can't prosper. Everybody knows this. It's tradition. Verse 4, since man was placed on the earth, that the triumphing of the wicked man is short, and the joy of the hypocrite is but for a moment. That is kind of sort of true. But you know what? There are lots of wicked people. So I mean some really bad wicked people that died fat and happy. Not a twinge in their conscience. And if I start looking at what's going on with the righteous now and what's going on with the wicked now, I'm going to get tripped up. David did in Psalm 37. Asaph did in Psalm 73. Both the same problem. God, maybe you have me mixed up with one of the enemy. I'm wearing your jersey. I'm the one that wants to please you. I am pitted out right now. That guy over there who doesn't give a rip what you think, he's doing fine. Remember in Asaph in Psalm 73 said, you know, when I thought that way, I thought maybe I've kept myself pure in vain. Maybe it's not worth it. And of course, the solution to David in Psalm 37, the solution to Asaph in Psalm 73 was just look farther down the road. Because, yeah, the wicked may be prospering, but it is going to be temporary. And there's going to be an accounting. And the righteous may suffer, but that's also going to be temporary. And they're going to receive an eternal reward. So, sort of true, verse 5. But continuing to talk about the wicked man. Though his haughtiness mounts up to the heavens, and his head reaches to the clouds. We've talked about the nose in the air, kind of arrogance. That's the Hebrew intent here. Yet he will perish forever like his own refuse. This is Zophar giving this fabulous wisdom that wicked people are cut off in their prime. Those who have seen him will say, where is he? He will fly away like a dream and not be found. Yes, he will be chased away like a vision of the night. The eye that saw him will see him no more, nor will his place behold him any more. His children will seek the favor of the poor. In other words, his children will have to beg from poor people. And his hands will literally pay back his wealth. Now we're going to see Zophar give away what he has come to think of as Job's sin. Nobody's really actually mentioned any specific sin. They've all just said it's hidden. But Zophar gives us down in verse 19 and 20 that he thinks he knows what the sin is that Job's guilty of. That somehow all of Job's wealth came from dishonest gain. So when Zophar talks about the wicked man in verse 10, he says, you're going to have to give it all back. Yes, bones are full of his youthful vigor, but his vigor or his energy will lie down with him in the dust. Verse 12, 13, and 14 just flashed me back to my childhood. Seven children in our family, and I snuck a piece of candy. Candy was put out in our house just for the guests. The kids weren't allowed to eat it. And I never could understand, well, then why did you put it out in bowls where it's right in front of my nose tempting me? Well, I snuck a piece. And my Nazi stepmother came through, and she suspected that I had a piece of candy, so I stuck it under my tongue. And she told me to open my mouth. So I opened my mouth. I was thinking about swallowing the candy and destroying the evidence, but I didn't want to waste a good piece of candy because I didn't know when I would get another one. So I just hid it under my tongue and it worked. So see if anything in verses 12, 13, and 14 sound like that. Because remember, they've accused Job of trying to hide his sin. Though evil is sweet in his mouth, the wicked man, and he hides it under his tongue, though he spares it and does not forsake it, in other words, he doesn't spit it out or swallow it, still keeps it in his mouth hidden, yet his food in his stomach turns sour. In other words, you may be able to hide that sin, but it's ultimately going to poison you. It becomes cobra venom within him. Verse 15, the wicked man swallows down riches and vomits them up again. God casts them out of his belly. He will suck the poison of cobras. The viper's tongue will slay him. He will not see the streams, the rivers flowing with honey and cream or milk and honey. He will restore that for which he labored. And the word for labored is to labor wickedly or to scheme or dishonest labor. So I'll read it that way. He will restore that for which he labored wickedly and will not swallow it down. From the proceeds of his business, his shady business, he will get no enjoyment because here's what Zophar says Job's guilty of. No evidence, just what he's come up with. By the way, when we're suspicious of people, be really careful who reinforces that idea. Because the devil can, you know, he'll tell you all kinds of nefarious motives that people have. And whenever I fall for that, the Lord say, Bob, you don't know what anybody's thinking. So don't go there. Certainly don't listen to the devil. He's a liar. So this happens. He's not going to be able to enjoy what he's labored dishonestly for, verse 19, because he's oppressed and forsaken the poor. He's violently seized a house which he did not build, because he knows no rest in his heart. Or, and one way to translate that Hebrew word speaks of your deepest desires, strong desires, or greed. And I think that kind of fits. He knows no rest in his greed, and but he will not save anything that he desires. He's going to lose it all. So they're saying, Job, the way you got rich was because you took advantage of people. Where in the world he got that idea, I don't know. We know why Job was rich. The Bible says in chapter 1 and chapter 2 that God blessed him. So it wasn't from greed. I've noticed maybe a little bit of jealousy in here. I don't know why people like to take pot shots at people that have more than they do. But you see a little bit of that. Verse 21, nothing is left for him to eat. Therefore, his well-being will not last. In his self-sufficiency, he will be in distress. Every hand of misery will come against him. And, of course, that is what happened to Job right at his peak. He's saying that's the way it happens to all wicked people. Verse 23, when the wicked man is about to fill his stomach, God will cast on him the fury of his wrath and will rain it on him while he's eating. He will flee from the iron weapon, and a bronze bow will pierce him through. In other words, he'll try to run away from one threat, but another threat's going to nail him to the wall. It is drawn and comes out of his body. In other words, his punishment is just waiting in the wings. Yes, the glittering point comes out of his gall. I don't know why he has to make a big deal out of that. Terrors come upon him. Total darkness is reserved for his treasures. An unfanned fire will consume him. It shall go ill with him who is left in his tent. Remember, Job's kids were all killed in their own home. The heavens will reveal his iniquity, and the earth will rise up against him. The increase of his house will depart, and his goods will flow away in the day of God's wrath. This is the portion from God for a wicked man, the heritage appointed to him by God. And you can put in parentheses, this is you, Job. Now, I got 15 minutes to give Job's response. It's long, but it's brilliant logic, and I don't have to make too many arguments about it. I think it's our explanations. It's a really good chapter, I think, to hang on to in case you run into anybody that gives you that whole line